This is Hidden Killers Live with Tony Bruschi, Stacey Cole, and Todd Michaels.
Alex back. All right. The South Carolina Supreme Court hears oral arguments starting on Wednesday on Alec Murdaugh's appeal. But the conversation almost nobody is having is what happens after a reversal. If a reversal happens, not the legal theory, the practical reality. What does it look like when the state has to retry the most high-profile murder case in its history with a compromised record, aged evidence, and a defendant who's already locked up in financial crimes? Criminal defense attorney and host of the podcast Defense Diaries, Bob Mata is with us to help break down the latest chapter. It's not even quite a sequel. This is kind of like a made-for-TV movie portion of it right now. We'll see if it gets the green light for another Hollywood release. Bob, when you look at this case and the Murdaugh appeal heading to oral arguments with Becky Hill's perjury conviction, now formally part of the appellate record, and the defense arguing the wrong legal standard was applied at the toll hearing, what do you think the Supreme Court justices are most focused on, and what would you be watching in their questioning that might signal where this is headed this week?
Well, I think ultimately toll requires the defense to prove that a juror actually changed their vote because of Becky Hill's conduct, because that's ultimately what the core question is going to be. It is like with any kind of law, when you're talking about precedent and they're trying to figure it out as we go along, which is how the law works. It's ever evolving. It's a very fluid situation, the law, even though it may take a very long time for law to change. It's always interpretation, how one person interprets it against another. Another's interpretation. So ultimately, that is the core question on whether or not toll requires the defense to prove that they actually changed the vote. And that's really a question of law, not fact. And, so what I'd be looking for ultimately, if they're going to be pressing the AG's office, because if you've never watched any kind of hearing oral arguments in the appellate courts or the higher courts, they're vastly different than what you're looking at when you're watching a trial. All right. It's like you get what they call a hot bench up there, and you have very limited time. Typically you'll have 15 minutes, and sometimes you want to reserve some of that for a rebuttal. So you might go 10 minutes, and that goes like in the blink of an eye. And it's like, if you're stepping up prepared as the attorney, this is what I'm going to argue, because this is what I'm getting the vibe that the court is going to be kind of focusing on, this one particular issue. Mm-hmm. And you're trying to make that argument, but you're, 25 words into what you're saying, and the judges start in on you. Mm-hmm. Because the judges have specific questions that they need answered, and they want to see what the argument of the attorney is with respect to whatever that particular issue is. So they're always worth watching, and it's like people that have never watched it are like, oh man, that judge is mad. I'm like, no, that's just how appellate mm-hmm. The appellate process works. It's just vastly different. So, ultimately, I think the questions are the justice going to be asking the state to defend toll standard of the result? Are they going to be pressing the AG's office? Like what legal standard did Justice Toll apply? And then cite the authority for that. So, and it's going to be a really interesting argument. I tend to think, as much as it's probably going to upset people, I tend to think Murdaugh's probably going to get another trial.
I'm leaning there too. And here's the thing. And this is what it eludes me. I get it from a legal standpoint, because we're going off of the rulings of the judge, not just what somebody is saying. But it kind of reminds me of an adult and a child going back and forth on something. The child is the juror. The adult is Judge Toll. The child is saying, okay, all these other kids on the playground are saying, okay, everything Becky said, I'm good. She didn't bother me. But one kid is saying, no, she said this to me, and that really affected my decision-making process. It is what it is. And Judge Toll, the grown-up, is going, no, it didn't. Even though they're going, no, it really did. It really did affect it. No, I don't think so. I don't think so. But it did. The actual juror has already said it did.
Yeah.
So it's not like we're backing this up going and like interpreting language like we're doing on every other case where it's like, what does this word mean? They said it did. They said it affected it affected their decision. Yeah. Now, I mean, and then judge saying, no, it didn't. And so now it's going to another grown-up, the Supreme Court, and they're going to go and say the same thing. Okay, this person is saying it affected their decision. Now, the judge said, no, it didn't. Now, the judge is not that person's mind, is not that person's opinion. That's their own opinion, now filtering and overshadowing what that original person said happened. Mm-hmm. Why are we interpreting what another judge interpreted over what the actual juror has said? The juror has spoken their truth. They said it affected them. This is more so a question of whether we value the juror's opinion or not. At the end of the day, if a juror comes back and says, no, this happened, either we believe them or we don't. And if we don't believe them, that really opens up the door to really a lot of shit of, oh, well, apparently they can influence a juror and we have evidence that she did. And the juror said that. But I guess if another court says, eh, it's good enough, and we don't care how it actually affected you. Wow. Well, I guess we can go start fucking with jurors in every trial in South Carolina going forward with clerk of courts, because the state doesn't really take it all that seriously now, does it?
Yeah. And it's, that's really kind of how you break this thing down. But just so people kind of understand, there's a Supreme Court case called Remmer that's from like the 50s. Okay. And what that case did, it was kind of on point as to this situation. And that case established a clear presumption. Okay. Mm-hmm. Meaning that if a third party, and plug in Becky Hill here, yeah, if her improper contact with the juror during the trial is just shown, if she's making contact with jurors and it's improper, the prejudice is locked in. Okay. The presumption is locked in. And at that point, it then becomes the state's burden. Okay. To prove that contact was harmless. So it's a burden shift. Okay. And that's the law of the land.
Yeah.
And what Atoll did is that she flipped that on its head. And that's when she came with this shit, like, show me a juror who changed their vote because of Hill's conduct, and then I'll give you relief. And which is a much higher, much more difficult burden. And she's flipped it onto the defense.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So she is in effect, because if the court rules in favor of Toll, they've effectively changed the law. That means that Remmer is no longer the law of the land.
Mm-hmm.
So that's how big this decision is. And it, in my estimation, it should be the burden on the state. If or whichever party is coming in saying that there was improper third party contact with the juror, whichever side comes in with that, it's got to be the other side to say, well, yeah, that may be true, but it was harmless.
Mm-hmm.
All right. And that should always be the case to me. You know, I mean, like, make the burden shift to the party who is really getting the benefit of the contact when they shouldn't be, to prove that it should stand up. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
And what she did is she flipped it on its head. You know, and I just think that ultimately, if the court's going to follow the law, there's only one way to come down on it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and so it then becomes a question, do they find the government's argument to be like the kind of argument that they're going to be willing to change the law on? You know, is it that strong, that argument? Because that's really what it is. That's why I was saying earlier, it's a question of law, not a question of fact.
Well, and in that same regard, what happens to the Mallory Beach case? If you've got all of these cases relying on this one case and this one falls, what happens?
Every case in the land that's relying on that case, if it becomes bad law, like if you go in to shepherdize it and you're like, okay, is this still good law? And Remmer pops up with a red flag next to it and it shows that it's been overturned, you can no longer rely on it.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. So it's not just Mallory's case. It's all the cases
in
the entire country that rely on that law, because we see out of the cases that we cover, which is just usually the stuff that's streamed, there are thousands and thousands of cases going on. And I can assure you there are issues with jurors all the time, all the time in cases. You know, it's one of the first things that you're looking at. If you're on the losing side from the defense side, you're saying, okay, well, did anything weird go on with the jury during this thing? You know, Allison and I have had multiple times where we're like, oh, and when we're going in for a motion for a new trial before the appellate process starts, that's going to be one of the grounds that we're looking at. So, I mean, it just happens all the time. I mean, again, we're all human beings. Human beings make mistakes. Human beings will talk with one another. They may see something they shouldn't have seen. They may have formed a conclusion or an opinion on something they shouldn't have formed a conclusion on or an opinion on. And like if that somehow gets out, and we live in this world where everything is out there for public consumption once it's on the internet, I mean, we see it all the time.
Yeah.
I can't think of a case wherein we haven't heard some kind of jury issue in forever. I mean, if you go back to every case that I've covered, like I am hard pressed to think of one where there hasn't been some kind of jury issue raised, whether it's Reed, whether it's like, what was the Black Swan one with the ballet, the ballet?
Yeah. Ashley Benefield.
You know, are they getting shit? Is there a juror that's texted? Like there's always some shit that's going on. So yeah, the impact of a change in the law is always massive.
Yeah,
but that's what I'm saying. Like it's a big deal if they're going to overturn a 1954 case that's been the law of the land for all that time.
Yeah,
there's a lot of implications here. It's not just about Alec Murdaugh.
No,
And it would mean a lot if they say, nope, this doesn't really matter. Yeah. We'll see what happens. And as we know, I mean, obviously this is not like a jury trial. Okay, now they're going to go back and deliberate. They're going to issue a written statement, a written ruling on this at some point in time, which could take days. It could take weeks. It could take months. Once they put their arguments out here this week, Bob, how long do you think we're going to wait till we see an answer on that?
I mean, it could take a minute. Yeah. You know, I mean, it's like,
and it should.
It should.
Yeah.
It should. I mean, they're going to go back, unless in their estimation it's so clear cut, you know, because you'll get one of the justices that writes the opinion, and you'll get concurring opinions, and then if there's dissenting opinions. So when they put out the opinion, it's going to be lengthy. So I mean, it's gonna take a while, you know, and it's like they're on nobody's clock, you know. I mean, it's like that process is something that, you know, can sometimes take 8 months, 12 months, sometimes a little over a year to get an opinion back. I mean, like Avery shit, like in Stephen Avery's case, you know, they wait forever on those things when they have post conviction stuff. So it's going to really just depend on where they're at with it and, you know, how it's being fought, you know, and it's like, you always have that kind of like the political undertones when you're talking about high courts, because of appointments, and you know, and it shouldn't be the case, but it is, you know, so we'll see how it plays out, man. But like, it's not going to be quick unless it's just like, nah, we're like, this is a non-starter.
Which, who knows? Anything is possible. Your thoughts in the comments section on YouTube or our Substack. Check it out. The links are in the description to weigh in with your thoughts. We will continue the Alec Murdaugh conversation there.
Want more on this case and others? Then press subscribe now and don't miss a moment of true crime coverage from Tony Bruschi and the Hidden Killers podcast.
Normally in these ads, you'd expect someone like me to ask you to buy something. But I want to ask you to do something different. I'm Dave Farenthold, and I'm a reporter for the New York Times. I'm an investigative reporter, which means that I follow the money, inside of government and outside of government. The point of my job is to find things people are trying to hide. It involves talking to lots of people. It involves looking through lots and lots of documents. And if there weren't folks like me to go beyond the surface to understand who is really shaping what the government does, the public will be left in the dark about what the government's doing with your tax money, what the government's doing to you through regulations and spending. If you're like me and you think this kind of journalism is important, seek out a news source that does firsthand, fact-based reporting. If that's the New York Times, thank you. If that's your local paper, that's great too, because where you get your information matters.